people are saying they don't recognize you in the chat. It's because your hair's not up.
Correct.
How long has it been since you had your hair up in the wheel style?
Since work from home started, late 2020 was when it ended for realsies. So right. 2.5 years ago or so.
Interesting. How long is it now? You doing full samurai ponytail in the back?
No,
slick back.
No. It all stops right here.
All right.
Real easy these days.
Nice. Me too. Mine's real easy. I just shaved it today.
Yeah.
So, man, it's been a while since, it's been like at least a year since you've been on here. And
is that true?
I think so. I'd have to look back for sure, but it's been a while.
All a blur, man.
That's also true. I still feel like 2020 has been the longest 3 years of my life. Like it feels like it's still 2020 and that nothing has changed. But working from home will do that to you, I think.
Yep.
So what's new? What's been now you're currently lead designer at Paddle Creek Games. I don't know if you heard me say earlier, I keep wanting to type Paddlefish.
Yes.
Every time. And I don't even know why. I don't know what that is. Like, it's just what's in my head for some reason.
There's Chucklefish.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I've been there here 11 months. 11 months now, about to the day. So it's been a very, very awesome 11 months. Best tools I've ever worked with in my whole career.
That's saying a lot.
Yeah.
What? Can you say what tools you're using?
They're custom built plugins for Unreal 5 that are just layered on top of amazing Unreal 5 tools like World Partitioning and Nanite. And I'm just kidding, a candy store.
And you're working on Fractured Veil.
Fractured Veil is the name of the game.
You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Open world survival game. Takes place about 100 years from now in the future. We are in Western Maui. The short version, right, is science went wrong, ripped wormhole-esque thing in environment. Now there is a multiverse of Mauis that you can eventually travel among when we launch. And, each of them will have different stuff. So you'll have a bunch of different reasons to move among them while also trying to figure out, where do you want your kind of home base to be. And most, if not all, islands won't last forever. So servers will come up and down and you will be motivated to move on.
But
a lot of cool stuff. Some Diablo inspired dungeon work has gone in really well. I get to do all the system design. I kind of do just most of the game design in general these days. There's not really another designer per se. So yeah, it's basically been like a glorified modding tool and experience where I've gotten to come in and live the dream of making whatever I think is good for the genre in 2023. And we currently plan to ship in September.
Nice. I love that you talk about it as modding because you, in my head, are, when I think of mods, I think of you. Like that's something that you've always been very, while I agree with you, something you've been very high on and something I think is a really good way for people to showcase their skill sets, build their skills, and just make cool shit, right? Because the tools are all there, especially if it's a game or content that you like. It's exciting to get in there and try and make something new inside of that. So that's really cool to me that you feel like you're getting to do that full time.
Yeah, I am. That's exactly right. Like, it truly is living the dream on that regard. Best tools, best pipeline. I basically make my own hours. Everyone just trust me. I trust them. We all get our stuff done. We're a small, very fast and strong team.
I mean, that's also a big part of the dream, right? Autonomy and trust, like not having people micromanage you. Like that's something that I have always super appreciated. And I have currently as well, and really appreciate when I could just identify a problem or be given a problem and can just focus on what's the right answer. And let me figure out if that's a me problem, if it's an us problem. Like whatever that is, like that's a big deal to me too. So the thing that I like about having people back on, like this is, I think you're probably your fourth, maybe fifth time. I don't even know.
I think it's like our eighth.
Is it eighth?
I think so.
It's some number above one, right? Yeah. And then, but the thing I love about that is quite literally we could talk about anything, right? Like we've gone through your career. We've talked about portfolio specifically. We've talked about mobile design. We talked about a lot of different things. And I honestly purposefully came in here without an agenda because I think I want to try and get the chat a little more involved, get some questions from people that are curious about different things, different aspects of design. There's also a lot of stuff out recently and coming out soon that, sure. that I think there's some good things to talk about. I definitely want to talk a little bit about Diablo. And I know you mentioned V Rising earlier. And so there's a lot of things we could talk about, but I would definitely want this to be kind of a, hey, if people have things they're curious about, want to ask about, let's talk about whatever's on your mind. And with that, what's on your mind? Anything specific you want to start with?
I just booked my BlizzCon.
Did you?
Hell yeah. The Dude. Announcement happened. One of my buddies typed to me in all caps, BlizzCon, and I typed back BlizzCon, and he's like my main dude that I always do BlizzCon with. And then like an hour later, we were booked.
I did not know that it was a thing again. This is the first year that it's back? Like I hadn't even heard this yet.
This is very fresh news. Yep.
Now, I was at the last one, right? The last you real one?
2019. Yeah. Yep, we were all there.
Man, that was a blast. The thing I loved lot about it was just how immersive it was and how immersed everyone was. Like you just looked around, it was just like everybody's eating this up, and it was just a lot of fun to see.
Yeah, no, I mean the community, being part of that community, you know, that's I don't know. Like you can hate on any internet community, like the greater BattleNet community, this or that, but people that attend BlizzCon have been absolutely fantastic the 7 or 8 times I've gotten to be there now. And I just got Frostmourne, which is something I always wanted to collect, and I couldn't collect like 14 years ago when it was printed the first time.
Oh.
So I got to figure out where it fits, but it's here.
I'm sure you'll find a space for it.
Yeah.
Oh man, we got some questions in the chat. How do you like working with San? And EP Toolshed says he taught me a lot.
Yeah, I don't work with San directly per se. That is far above my pay grade, but I know who they are, and they've been very kind in my limited interactions.
Hey, that's nice. What's their role?
They're one of the like clients, for lack of a better term, from my perspective.
Gotcha.
Like founding, like.
Okay.
Yeah, way.
Gotcha. I'm sure there's some interaction there, right? Though. Or at least you're aware of wishes. And, yeah.
Everyone likes everyone.
That doesn't suck. Like it's always interesting when you're at a place where people like each other but also respect each other, because those are not always true.
Totally.
Not always appreciate those. Popco asks, what's your skin routine there, buddy?
Viking Revolution. You start at like $35. Check it out.
Viking Revolution?
Yeah. Get the whole little skincare set. Build the habits with the right things, the right times of the week. Easy.
Is that really the thing you sent to me before when I asked? Okay. Yep.
I mean, there's plenty of other ones of similar competitive note, but that one served me well when I was getting started.
All right.
And then any additional tips aren't free. You can DM me.
Let's see. Kai asks, I would like to hear what it was like working on Rogue Company. I did assignments back at Full Sail analyzing parts of it and always found it interesting. I'd be curious to hear what parts were analyzed. Yeah, what parts did you analyze? And then I think probably just start off like your overall impression of working on it was cool. Because you had like some very similar things from like Agents of Mayhem and the agency you were working on there and those kind of kits, and then that kind of translated directly into the stuff you were doing there.
Directly, yes. Those were literally like my two main combat design jobs of my career, and they were both Saturday morning cartoon secret agent-y badass characters. So that was weird to work in a very similar IP twice. But yeah, I mean, Rogue Company was great. I got to own two of the Rogues that came out last year. I wasn't there to see the ship of the second Rogue, so another game designer had finished that. But yeah, Umbra and Juke were the two Rogues that I worked on mostly. And then I was a part of a lot of different reworks from a systemic perspective around the toughness and speed system, we all collaborated hard on, rebuilding all the perks, expanding that from like somewhere in the teens to roughly like 50 perks, and which ones were scalable versus which ones weren't, and how we could make those into like different rarities and assign them to different loadouts for different rogues, on and on. All that stuff. I had a hand in or more. But yeah, the whole design team was really tight and good at supporting each other, and we play tested like at least 1 hour a day, which was the coolest, most amazing thing I've ever seen that I'm sure I won't get to see again in my career. Like every morning, 9 a.m. to 10, or no, it's 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. Everyone was there. We were playtesting the game. Everyone understood the latest updates, what we were all trying to do from level design, from combat design, from systems design. It was awesome. It was the most thought-provoking way to start your day.
That's really interesting. I don't know if I knew that.
One of my favorite things about their culture.
That's really cool. Like, it's hard enough to get, you know, a couple of hours for the whole team at any point to play a game, much less, you know, as you said, every day. Like, you did that every day.
5 days a week. And then 2 days a week, we would also do it in the afternoon, where we would scale it to like, try to scale to like 80 different people on the team to play. But every single morning we'd have minimum eight, anywhere from like 8 to 16, which were, we needed multiples of 4. So,
wow.
Usually multiples of 2, 4.
And so, now that game is like online only, though, right? As far as there wasn't a single player
component. An online third-person arena shooter. Yep.
And I guess that's obviously the major difference between, you know, Agents of Mayhem and that one is, you know, same work, different mentalities.
Different use cases, completely different use cases in a lot of ways, right? I'm having to think about how the combat kits in Rogue Company will interact with all the other combat kits, both collaboratively and competitively. And then what does that mean if you change the height and the level? What does that mean if you give this type of angle instead of that? What does it mean if this room only has 2 egress points instead of 3? Like, there's just, yeah, all the arena game design to think about.
Yeah. And I remember when we were working on Agents of Mayhem, there was some late game choices, like, you know, suddenly we're going to give somebody a triple jump right now, something that like we weren't planning for, you know, that whole time, and that completely changes the dynamic of things. Like, I assume you wouldn't have those kind of major changes late in development of something when you've got a competitive shooter, right?
Correct. Especially in the traversal realm. Yeah. That's like the scariest place to add things.
Yeah, it sure is.
Just period. Yeah. that's how you make level designers hate you just permanently, is as a combat or system designer, you keep adding traversal mechanics.
Oh man.
It's true. You remember so many previous designs, I don't want to say inert, but like you put them at risk for sure.
Man, that was the case when I was working on the Simpsons game. I built the first level for that game that was our like vertical slice. And I built everything with temp mechanics based on what we assumed we were going to do, right? So it was, you know, that kind of vibe. And then as we got into production, they're like, oh, we've got to change all these mechanics. So I'm like, I can't change this whole level that's essentially done, right? So now we got to like figure out how to make this stuff work. So that was a bit frustrating, but you know, sometimes those are the growing pains you go through. We also were supposed to change engines. We were developing it what was it called? Crytek? No. Oh my gosh, what am I forgetting here? We were using an engine, and then we were building an engine, and we were supposed to switch over, but then that switch never happened. So we ended up building it in that original prototype engine, and it was wild. I can't remember what. I can't think of the name now. Renderware Studio.
Did I know it?
Renderware Studio. That's what it was.
Oh yeah.
And it was not fun to work in. So.
Wow.
Yeah,
what a name, dude.
Yeah, that's what I'm just
so
like.
Long ago.
That was 2005. So man,
that's 18 years ago now.
Sure is. Feels like yesterday. Yeah. Some of those pains feel like yesterday. Oh man. Mech and Gamer asks, any advice for someone who wants to get into level design and want to go to school for it?
Ooh, well, fortunately, you know, there's more than 1,000 modding tools you can access if you own the game, some of which you can access for free because they're free-to-play games. On Steam, you can filter games by the Steam Workshop tag, and there's Steam Workshop. That means you can mod it. In many cases, level design should be relevant there, and then from there, you could isolate what genre you really want to focus your level design talents on. Not that that has to be where your first job lands or anything, but it'd be cool to probably see a focus of one or two genres of level design, like you understanding how to design levels in a 2D platformer is very different than a third-person arena shooter. So there's a little bit of overlap, of course, but there's a lot that's not. So showcasing a couple different understandings of that would work, and whatever modding tools make sense.
I feel like this question actually is two different questions, right? Like, I 100% agree with your answer. Like if you leave the and off of it, if you want to get into level design, that is absolutely the answer, right? And honestly, you should even look at things like Mario Maker too, right? Like, they're like literally is built to help you learn. Meet Your Maker
is the hotness right now.
Which one?
Meet Your Maker.
Oh yeah. Yep. Yeah, man. But if you want to go to school for it, that's a totally different question, right? Because
yeah, and I intentionally didn't answer the school part because, like, I just told you how to do it. You don't need a school for it. Now, if you want to go pay a bunch of experts to tell you what to do for a while, that's cool. And if that's the way you want to learn, I mean, that's the way a lot of us did it. That's great.
Right.
I'm just also saying there's a lot of other ways to do it in today's world.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I agree with you. Like, if you just want to learn the skill, go learn the skill, you know, and there's cheap and free ways to do that and to get experience doing it. And like, and I think you'd agree with this too. Like, if you really want to learn how to make levels, recreate levels that you know, right? Like, play through something and then mod and recreate it and understand why they made the choices they did. And, you know, like, basically analysis is a great way to understand why choices are made and why you should make certain decisions when you're laying out a level.
Yeah. Do you mind if I put a hyperlink in your chat? Is that okay?
Oh, of course. Yeah.
worldofleveldesign.com. I haven't thought about that website in like 3 years, and it just dawned on me while you were talking.
Oh, I don't even know that.
It used to be one of the holy grails of starting in level design back when we were like it modding CS 1.6 levels and stuff.
It's got current updates, so that's cool.
Yeah, the people behind that, I think the main guy behind that's in Tampa.
Okay.
I swear something like that's true. I always hoped to meet him, but I never got to so far. But yeah, incredible website for any level designer or any environment artist that just wants to kind of be able to work that pipeline better with game design.
There you go.
And that's been an authority since like 2010 at least.
Interesting. Yeah, no, that's cool. I'm going to check that out. I haven't seen that one yet.
Yeah, that's what taught me how to use the hammer editor and stuff way back when.
Oh, man, that's a way back too.
Counter-Strike and Left 4 Dead. Yeah.
Well, the same time frame, right? Like probably in the early 2000s, mid 2000s.
Yeah, like 2004 to 2010
were
very heavy years of modding for me.
Nice. Let's see. Second question. What's the difference between working on Rogue Company and Agents of Mayhem? What I analyzed during my class was mostly about the different states the player could be in and how animations work the way they did. So maybe not exactly what was worked on. Animation dependent was Rogue Company? Because Agents of Mayhem was pretty animation dependent.
Oh, I mean, big time. All of our art disciplines were amazing on Rogue Company. Like, very, very high quality. And yeah, we definitely had custom animations everywhere that we thought was necessary from a game design perspective. And animation always delivered. Like for example, Umbra, which was a nightmare for everyone because there's a remote control spider that crawls out the back of its head, and then the player controls it and runs around. There's this whole second player state. And like, nobody liked me, right, for that, probably. But everyone killed it. And animation in particular, you know, we ended up being like, yo, in 1.2 seconds or whatever the time was, I need this spider out of his head and on the ground in the player's control. Period. Because they had like these cool crawling down things. I was like, this looks gorgeous. You're amazingly talented. This is taking too long. Gameplay can't do this. Because again, online competitive shooter, we got to have the times right no matter what. Whereas I use that example because of Agents of Mayhem, we could be like, I'll figure it out. Make him invulnerable the whole time. Remove that status effect at the end of the animation. Boom, ship it. So yeah, just completely different use cases from a player perspective. Therefore, a lot of different implementation differences, even though they, do have those similarities.
Yeah, no, that totally makes sense. It's weird how, like, not weird, it's our job, but like when we're thinking about the different restrictions and accommodations we need to make, they can be completely different based on the situation and the type of content we're creating, right? So you can have in my experience of mostly level-based and open-world stuff throughout my career, the initial things I think about to solve problems would be very different than someone that's working on either, you know, a mobile game or something that's more competitive and has a very different set of restrictions. And that's, that's our life. It's like there's lots of potential outcomes for a lot of the things we do, and we got to find the right one for the situation that we're in. It's not always easy. Harley's asleep back here and about to kick me. What's up?
I just got a message from someone you've recently hosted. Yeah. Who just tossed me a softball. And this should have been my first answer to the question earlier about how to get into level design. And also, pardon me for saying mods, because there's actually a better answer for the first time. UEFN. UEFN.
I was going to bring that up. Yeah.
Everywhere you need to be, regardless where you are in your career. If you are not owned by another company at this time, you really should be playing with UEFN. That's the next huge step into the metaverse. And regardless of any perspective on that, you go make a ton of cool games over there. You eventually monetize, you build communities, you can even eventually export that game into a native Unreal 5 project. I think they said not yet, but eventually that's the plan. And it's just incredible. It's like the easiest time. And we always said, oh, it's like so much easier now, but it's like UEFN is the easiest way to do this by far.
So for those that are unfamiliar, give a little overview of what UEFN is and how it works.
Okay, so Unreal Engine, Fortnite, you know Fortnite. Fortnite Creative, you at least know it probably exists. There's this other mode in Fortnite where you can have other experiences that are created by other users. Cool, user-generated content. We love that. Great. There's a lot of amazing tools that's been built in Fortnite Creative, but there are also some limitations that just were always going to be limitations for the system. So long story short, they basically, and you know, I don't work for Epic, so grain of salt me, I'm just interpreting here. They basically built like a modding tool for Fortnite that now supports, you know, everything you need to the extreme, the monetization, the networking and account management, all the assets that you can use in your games, on and on, the ability to share among the community. It's just like, so I started in Warcraft 3, so like 2002, Warcraft 3. Custom maps were a big deal. This is one of the first games to ever have a custom map. And again, that was 21 years ago. That's nuts. And with that came custom tools, of course, to make the custom maps. That was the first like metaverse for me, was that, so to speak, the little Warcraft 3 metaverse. And so seeing this 21 years later, and now instead of taking this little RTS, well, I say little, it was a great game, but this, you know, smaller RTS and a set of tools, and you can instead come to UEFN and work on any genre, use a ton of templates you can find, all the AAA assets, audio, gameplay systems. You simulate the job. And that's the same with modding. You simulate the job you want, but not only do you just simulate the job here, but you can collaborate so easily, you can publish so easily. Like, there's nowhere else to be.
All right. What if you don't care for Fortnite content?
So it's all about the tool, right? So here's the thing. I'm sure, I don't know the extent of curation that is or will occur on importing art assets into UEFN. Of course, there must be something there. But I'd like to think that the art will eventually expand far beyond the stylized nature of Fortnite. So if it's that aesthetic that people don't like, which I totally get, yes, there are solutions. There are already solutions in progress that you can go grab.
Nice. I mean, I had to, somebody's thinking about the question, right? I had to at least ask it.
Totally.
All right. So Popco asked a question that I'm actually curious about. I said, as you're so close to shipping the game you're working on, is there a feature that you had cut in order to make the dates? And if so, how do you cope with removing a feature you wanted to see in the game?
I've had to do this a few times. Well, let me, I guess, attack it backward. Maybe I cope with these every time this happens a little better than the last time, I guess, just from the thicker skin of it all. The first time I probably was rather emotional about it. I did not understand. And I think that's kind of the point I want to make, is it's about helping your team members understand why. Just always be cool and help people understand why. And when that's not present, it's very difficult to cope with those situations. Yeah. But, you know, that's good feedback to give the other people involved, too. And then it can be better the next time. And so it was for me. We kept running into new issues each time this would go through, especially on mobile games. But but that's just the way of it. Like you just, you pivot. So generally if features got cut and then that might free up capacity in some other ways, I could also cope with it by saying, hey, well, maybe we can support building more content over here in this different way. Now we have three game designers that have X amount of capacity each week that could do this other thing instead. So always making lemonade, but usually it's if losing feature, turn it into a content opportunity.
Mm. I think the thing I do to make myself feel a little bit better is I'm like, hey, we can hold that for the sequel, right? Like there's hope that it's
in the backlog.
Yeah. Like it's a, not that that ever really happens, but at least right. It's a bit of like a, not all hope is lost, right?
Sure.
So that doesn't suck. Anything on your current project that you cut that you didn't want to or that you can talk about?
Honestly, we just keep getting to add stuff.
That's cool.
Yeah, no, again, it's been wonderful. Like we've had some delays. We've moved some stuff around, reprioritized and all, but no, there's nothing that's been cut. Certainly not.
Nice. That's rare.
I mean, I might have built some content that I was like, I don't like this content. I'm going to gut it and redo it, but right. It, only on a content perspective.
I mean,
that thing's been removed, really.
That's different, right? Like, that's us making a good choice for the design of the game other than, hey, we're removing something because we're out of time or we don't have the resources to allocate to this, which happens regularly in development. Let's see. Someone said they downloaded Game Maker. Have you ever used Game Maker?
Yes.
What are you?
Goodness, yes.
That's old school,
it's
man.
It's probably the best 2D game engine on the planet, objectively speaking. But by all means, Construct 3 and others are also super good. And Unity, of course, is super good for 2D. Generally, if I'm working on a true 2D game, though, I'm going to go to a true 2D engine. That's just me, though. I like working in 2D. It's like so much simpler to implement.
So like, simple.
So much easier. So, yeah. I don't want to still have to deal with some 3D libraries to make 2D stuff happen and weirdness if I can avoid it, you know.
What's really interesting for me is I think in 3D, I don't know how to describe it other than to say that
perspective. You think in that perspective as you do it, yeah.
I just mean in general, like so when I'm designing something, I'm thinking about it spatially, like that's the way my brain works. So I almost always go into an editor and rough something out before I start to type anything about it because I need to feel the space. You know, like I go in with a list of ideas, right, of things I need to accomplish or, you know, what my overall objectives are and what the major beats are. But I need to be inside of it, whereas I think that's not true for a lot of people.
That's not how I do it at all. Yeah. It makes sense. It totally makes sense. Just not how my brain works. No, I'm thinking about the use cases and the major moments that can come off those use cases. And everything else should be defined by those moments.
Yeah.
Those moments are why we're here.
And I agree with that. And I just need to see the space it's going to be in before I can understand how it's going to work and how it's going to flow together. So it's just interesting. Like I think I found my home in like 3D spaces where like I haven't done a 2D game design. Honestly, since school, like everything has been, you know, I'm building in Maya or I'm building in an editor. And that's a very, very different space that I've been in for, you know, over 20 years. Be weird to come back out of it.
Yeah.
All right, let's see. For Rogue Company, when working on the characters, what do you think is the most important for equalizing a character's strength?
Well, the term use case comes right back up. So when I'm assessing a character's combat kit in relation to other combat kits, I'm definitely looking at their relative usefulness in all the primary use cases that any player would try to do. And then the secondary use cases, if you can imagine, there might be some like less common ones, but they're common enough to track, and all maybe some tertiary ones if I'm really being specific here. And then, well, no, I'm just tracking all that, really. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't... I
think it's that easy. No, I mean, you know what I mean? Like, I think it's just, you just have to responsibly be able to see it all. And that comes with like, well, I've played a bajillion hours of video games, like like seriously. And so I have all this reference and all this stuff I can immediately pull for. So I can reach conclusions in a different way than a lot of other game designers just because of that different perspective I have from all that exposure. And so combining that, so I can just more, I can quickly and granularly see those use cases and then identify, now that we understand all those use cases, what's special about this combat fantasy that I've selected, this character I've selected. Okay, it's Umbra. Okay, I have Spider that comes out of head, among other cool things. I've chosen that fantasy. Now that we understand basic use cases, what are the special ones for Umbra I need to think about? Well, that's literally every moment, beat by beat, that you're controlling the spider, for one. I got to think about all that. How high can the spider jump? How fast can it move? Does it have a boost ability or something to close the gap faster? Will that just make players quit the game on the receiving end? You know, always thinking about friction too, always thinking about how this is going to influence player perception on both ends of PvP. But even on both sides of PvE too, if you're cooperating with another player, like, you know, you might be really good at stealing kills. That's subtle friction that will build up over time. You might be really good at relocating a teammate. And so once in a while, you relocate someone and it jars them and gave them a negative experience because of that. But all that. Use cases.
Yeah, that's it's interesting. The thing that I always tell people, and the thing that I, as I'm in my career a little bit longer, the thing that I start to realize is answers that come naturally to me do not come naturally to people that are newer at doing what we do. And so, like, I mentioned this the other day, but I was in a conversation with one of the design assistants, and they had a problem. And I was like, and to me, I was like, simplest thing in the world. Why don't you try this? And it was like a simple statement. And the response was, I never would have even thought of that. Like, and to me, I'm just like, I would have not thought of that. You know what I mean? Like, it was just like, to me, it was like the obvious answer and the simplest thing to do. It's going to take you 10 minutes. And the solutions you were throwing at me are hours worth of work. But it all comes down to, one, experience, right? And ultimately, totally, that's where those of us that have been doing this for a while, we pick up on like, oh, I've seen that before, or I've done this before. But what you're talking about is also relevant, which is the consumption of similar things, right? Like, you get ideas of how to approach things based on playing things and absorbing things that are similar in nature as well.
Yep. And remembering everything that felt good or didn't.
Yeah. Well,
and spreadsheets, yeah, and documents of notes.
Yeah. Wait, do you make notes and documents about things you play?
Absolutely.
Really?
Game designer 24/7, dude. Absolutely.
What a nerd.
I know. Like, half the gaming I do isn't even fun. What an idiot. I know.
In the first like 5 years of my career, I could not enjoy a game at all. Like, it was really, really hard to not be thinking about how it was done and how I would do it better, or understanding how it was done so I can then do it in a similar way down the road. Man, it's exhausting sometimes.
Yeah.
But in the end, it's worth it, right? Because we love what we do.
Yeah.
It's hard to get past that. So I start playing games that are not like what I work on for the most part, because then I can at least have fun doing that, which is part of why part of me never wants to work on a Final Fantasy Tactics game, because that genre, you know, the turn-based tactical strategy, I love it all the time. And I'm afraid if I ever work on one that I'm going to ruin that. And then I'm now going to be in a place where I don't get to actually just enjoy it.
That's deep, man. I don't think you'd ruin it.
I probably would. I'm just afraid of it. Yeah, that's right.
I will make sure you don't ruin it.
He ruined it. All right, what do we got here? You can use UEFN to make Fortnite good if you don't like it much.
That's true too, right?
Is there that level of
battle royale, like, way too easily now, so to speak? So, like, honestly, I've been tempted, because, like, I love Hunt Showdown. I love the extraction genre. It's the new hotness. It's going to blow up even more. It's great. There's probably, like, 50 of those that exist on UEFN by now. But that's what I would go do. That's my, like, greatest tip, is go make a cool extraction mode.
So, like, you can go and straight up change every, like, the entire structure of the game with this tool?
Make a whole game.
Interesting.
I mean, make a whole game, but you're still leveraging the hooks of UEFN, but you can still one day expand that into your own real game.
Interesting.
And no longer leverage those hooks.
All right, I need to dig into that a little bit. when I can find the time.
Like, I would be building curriculum around this yesterday if I worked at a school. Like, this is the future. This isn't some hype, dude. Like, this is, holy cow.
Well, and it's also free.
Awesome. And completely free.
Which is wild. All right.
Yeah, it's really impressive.
All right, I'll dig into it a little more. What's your approach in staying current with design trends?
Reading. Lots of reading. A little bit of listening, mostly reading. There's different blogs I read. I recently read through the new system design book from Ian Schreiber and Brenda Romero. That's the third book they've done together, I want to say. And it is an excellent reference to systems design, period. And I don't mean progression design. A lot of people think, oh, systems, that's like when I level up and stuff. Yes, but, or yes, and. Mm. Everything else, LOL, that's a system that works together. You know, death systems, combat systems, and AI, like literally, you know, gameplay design, right? You might be designing the weapon or the ability specifically, but there's still combat systems running that, and that's where system designers are still heavily present. So the book covers all that very, very well, and then also goes into, here's a bunch of spreadsheets and math if you want it, but they keep it completely separate from the rest. It's really well organized. So it's like, hey, we know this is going to melt most people's brains. Let's not muddy the philosophy with the math. I'll use this book for years to come. I think it's really well done.
All right. I'll pick that up. I've been looking for something along those lines. All right. I didn't even know about it.
I just brought that up. That's the question. Right. And then, yeah, some other blogs I could dig up. That book's a good example. I'd say twice a year, a game design book comes out that I'll just pick up and blast through. Dax's book was also good.
Digital or physical for you?
Digital. Yeah. I don't touch paper if I can help it.
All right.
I learned I'm a super toucher. I forget the scientific term, but it's a real thing. And my whole life, I have like gone crazy if I have to touch paper with my fingertips.
Oh, okay.
It's super random as that. It's the only kryptonite I have, to my knowledge.
Huh.
Or I guess certain other textures, maybe certain fabrics really bother me too. But like in the past year, I discovered that's a real thing.
Interesting.
But yeah, that's why I've always avoided paper. Plus, I'm left-handed when I write. So I grew up having to like arch my wrist completely around the binders of right-handed everything. And I like digital.
Interesting. All right. Huh. Yeah, no, the time that I've physically read the most through my life was with real books. I've transitioned to digital, but I'm finding I don't read as much as I listen to audiobooks mostly now. That's kind of my preferred method. I have some, you know, Kindle books and stuff that I want to read. It's a little out of sight, out of mind for me. Like I don't see a book, so I don't grab it. And that's a big part of ADHD. So that's probably a piece where digital is failing me and I need to find a better kind of instigation method or something.
Calendar.
That definitely helps. I use calendar.
That's what I do. Everything. I have calendar email me for all this stuff to make sure I do it.
Yeah. I should probably integrate it for something like that too. It's a good point.
Also masterclass.com. Always been a fan of that.
Oh yeah.
I've subbed. This is my fourth or fifth year now I've been subbed.
Oh, there's a lot of good stuff in there.
So much good stuff.
I really want to watch the Phil Ivey teaching poker. Like that's kind of like top of my list.
I've gone through that one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love that guy. That's a good way to do it as well. Yeah.
Bill Nye has a really strong one that's recently been published.
Will Wright has one in there too, right?
He does. That's the only game development one is Will Wright's.
Hmm.
Excellent introduction to game design and very interesting to hear him being like first generation game designer, hearing him explain the concepts and how different I explain those concepts. Just awesome to see.
Interesting.
It's great. It's absolutely great. I'm not sure you'd really learn anything, but you would see a different perspective on explaining it. But that's really cool.
My very first game dev starstruck moment was when I was at my first GDC, and that was in 2000. And I stood at a urinal next to Will Wright.
Yeah.
And I was like, keep your eyes up.
That's good. That was me with Tim Schafer. He just started talking to me. We're sitting at urinals. He started talking to me, and I'm like, oh my God, Tim Schafer's talking to me in the bathroom right now. Okay. Nice guy, of course.
Will did not talk to me. He did not, but that's okay.
Maybe he was waiting on you. That's
the first one. He might have been. You're right. I was just sitting there all giddy. Oh, we've got an interesting question. And have you ever had to design around technical limitations? My quick response to that would be, when don't we design around technical limitations?
Absolutely.
Like that's literally, if you're not designing around limitations, you're not designing, right? Like you're blue skying, you're daydreaming, right?
Designing in constraints is where we live.
Yeah. And just to make sure people understand what we're talking about, like there are restrictions in everything we do, whether it's memory budgets, frame time, you know, like there's always things that we're dealing with. So we have limitations in every single thing that we put into a game at all times. Everyone on the team does, right? Like we're all working within some kind of limitation, whether it's a budget or whatever.
Yeah. And even any feature that I'm designing, we might be halfway through the sprint of developing that feature and the engineer is like, hey, I ran into this thing and I can't give you what you asked for now. And now we're halfway through a sprint and we've got to really make lemonade on that one, you know, some way. That's happened so many times.
Yeah.
Where it's like mid-task, oops. It's like, what do you mean, oops?
Yeah.
Yeah. And sometimes it's like, yeah, I should have done a TDD on this one or something. And it's like, all right, sick.
Sometimes it's working through something to find where the limitation is too, but that's kind of your goal, right?
Yeah.
Do you have a link to that book? People are asking in the chat for it, and we can also put one in the show notes later.
Yeah, I'll make sure you get one.
Yeah.
I mean, again, you should know the two authors I said, by the way. If those were new names to you,
I still can't
get involved.
It's still Brenda Brathwaite to me. Like I have like,
sure.
It's hard for me to think Romero still, but,
sure.
But yeah, like it's, she's got some good stuff for sure.
Yeah.
And so does Ian. Like, it's great. Yeah.
And again, this is the third book. All three books have high reputation. But the most recent one,
their first one was the, like, what was it called? It was like, challenges for game design. It was like some kind of like, you know, quick, like
challenges. That's
yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That was a really,
cool honestly, book. Was great, like seriously great, because like, but we knew who they both were by reputation and all. They're like, oh, okay, more people, more big name game developers are about to write a book. Ooh, what's new? And then they drop that, and I'm like, woo, that's the most thought provoking thing I've seen in a long time since like Jesse Schell's The Art of Game Design. It was probably the first major thought provoking moment for me in my journey.
100%.
And then their book was probably the second big one.
Yeah, that is true for me as well. Like, I think we had a big drought of really good stuff until those two. And like, I point everyone to Art of Game Design. Like, that is my de facto, like, if you're interested about game design at all, this is the book you should start with. Like, it starts from absolutely ground zero.
Yeah.
Well, at least that's been true for a long time. I haven't read anything that's better for that yet, I guess I should.
I think it still applies. Yeah. The principles were almost timeless in most cases.
Yeah.
And I mean, it just ask you a bunch of questions to provoke thought.
Yeah.
Like it's so simple and awesome and useful. And there's the app, right? Or I assume the app still exists. There was the physical cards that went over the deck of lenses. And then the app as well. So
yeah,
a lot of ways to provoke thought with the Art of Game Design's material.
And that's kind of the main goal, right? Is to get you thinking about what you're working on from different perspectives.
Exactly.
Because it's
all about perspective.
Especially early on, it's real easy to have a very narrow perspective on things.
Yeah, and early on, I'd say it was hard for me to appreciate that book. I did not have an appropriate perspective to really, really appreciate the hype around that book when everyone else in college was talking about it. It didn't grow on me till after I got out of school. I probably owned the book for two and a half years before it finally clicked with me.
That's interesting, too.
Because I was just such a raw, open the modding tool and do the thing.
Yeah.
And then change and change and change until I think it's good, and then boom, ship it. And Shell's stuff was a bit more organized than mine. And that took some growing pains.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but that's what learning is, right?
Totally.
Is like all of us approach things the way that feels natural to us. And sometimes that's good, right? And sometimes it works, but usually we need some refinement.
Yeah.
I still need refinement these days. All right. When working on a survival game, What systems or mechanics do you think are necessary to make it feel like a survival game?
Resource management, number one.
Yep.
That's always the answer, right?
That's the only answer in my head.
Yeah, if you aren't in pain right now as a new player, we'll give you about 10 minutes of peace, right? And then, like, well, it depends on the game. You load into Ark on a beach, a raptor might just eat you 5 seconds in. It doesn't matter. Welcome to Ark. I love that. I love that. We're not doing that at Fractured Veil. I'm much kinder to a player, but just for the time, I loved that. But yeah, you know, resource management, right? So the basics of health, stamina, from a combat perspective, from a non-combat perspective, hunger, thirst, from a status effect perspective, you might have 3 or 6 status effects you're kind of tracking stuff on, you know, like bleeds, poison effects, shock effects, whatever the elements are that make sense in your game, the damage types that make sense for your game. But yeah, it's all about resource management, number one, and then understanding the relationship between all the interesting tools you have versus all the challenges you encounter in the world, because this genre is certainly known for letting you do crazy stuff, like super crazy stuff. So grappling hooks or whatever the case may be, you may have in a game like Ark that you certainly won't have in most other genres. And it's not just, ooh, go to the ledge where it's very yellow and clear, you should go up there. Or, you know, like in all these action games, it's like abundantly clear to do the thing. Where in survival games, open world sandbox survival games specifically, we're like, hey, if you can see that mountain, climb it, give it a shot, see what happens. That's what we're going to do. When we play test it, you know, we're just enjoying the sandbox too. So sandbox perspective, very, very different than all the linear perspectives. And that also comes back to use cases, right? Because like, grappling hook in, I don't know, a game like Uncharted. I don't even remember if I had a grappling hook. Sorry if it doesn't. But, you know, a game like that, that genre at least, very different than scaling a mountain in Atlas, because you were on a pirate ship 5 minutes ago, and now you're on top of a mountain with gliders and grappling hooks.
Yeah.
What? But that's awesome.
Oasis is the one I always think of right now. Like, I spent a bit of time in that one, and being able to go everywhere in that game was a little wild. That game was a humongous sandbox that I did not fully comprehend. I never fully comprehended it. Gallo played that game a lot.
Yeah, so Last Oasis, that partially inspired Fractured Veil, for the record. Our multidimensional travel and all is partially inspired by what they tried to do. Like we like a lot of the things that they've attempted. And frankly, I really like their melee combat system. I think there's a lot of strength to their game design, and I hope that it finds more success, because I like it too. But you're right, Gallo, that was like his religion for a while.
Yeah.
But that melee combat system was pretty like addicting, and being able to make bigger and bigger walkers, just their pacing of progression, right? It was really good. Even if you died, recovery, I don't know, I mean, we're veterans of the genre, but recovery was fine. It's fine. And they stopped doing the big multi-map thing, right? So a couple seasons ago, they moved it back to like a super map with more PvE things on the map now, like fortresses of the mobs and all this stuff. I haven't played it, so going off of patch notes there, but yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, I did not play it very long, but a buddy of mine worked on it, and so I had to support it. But it was a cool concept, and I tend to get a little overwhelmed with those kind of games where I feel like with anxiety and everything else, where it's like, if I don't know exactly what I'm doing and how to keep myself safe, I tend to get a little frustrated pretty quickly. I think that's something that a lot of the survival games don't, at least everyone that I've played didn't teach me how to be safe. Like, it taught me that it's dangerous, right? And that's great. But I also want to know how to be in less danger. And that pressure that's put there by not teaching that, I get it. But for me, it means I end up not doing it very long because I'm never in a place where I feel like I can progress.
Yeah, I agree. And what's fascinating is it's really as simple as, or if a player will just open their inventory and go to whatever tech screen or crafting screen, like usually it's only 2 or 3 steps away from being able to build your own base and craft your own tools and stuff. But to your point, tons of people just get stuck in that moment. I'm sensitive to that. And Fractured Veil's totally aware of that too. Because we have quest system. Most survival games don't have a full-blown quest system.
That is true.
So yeah. More ways than one, I mean, to convey meaning to the player, to say the least.
That's really good to know. Is the game in open access or anything, or is it?
No, we'll enter early access in September. Okay. Is the current statement.
Gotcha. Yeah, like a quest system, that stuff means a lot to me. Yeah. Sorry.
We're yeah, no. And it means a lot to a lot of players, I think. Yeah. You know, the quest system has barely been used in the genre. It's there's a ton of obvious benefits to using a quest system in various other genres. I mean, it even drives battle pass behavior. Like, yeah, goodness, absolutely. Goodness, give people objectives, they will do the objectives.
Yeah.
Give them rewards for these objectives. But I should correct myself a little bit. We did recently start selling access to Fractured Bells pre-alpha, is like the current production build. I do think, like, I don't know how many people have entered that recently, but yeah, I think quite a few people have picked that up early to support us, which is also really cool.
Oh, cool.
Not trying That's to sell to it, just clarifying.
No, I didn't know that. That's good to know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I, what were you talking about right before that? Sorry. The quest stuff. The objective stuff. Or quest system.
Oh, yeah, quest.
I've been playing through the new Heroes of Middle-Earth mobile game, right? And that has... You still can't play, can you?
Nope. They trolled me. I gotta interrupt you real quick, tell you the troll. So I get an update to the app and I'm like, ooh, Capital, you're doing it, you're fixing it for me, thank you, Capital, because you know you're great at Star Wars, I know Lord of the Rings is gonna be great, let me spend my money. And then exact same part of the Fatui, the first time user experience, the tutorial, I got stuck again. And I was like, well, this wasn't my patch, they reset my account info but didn't prevent that from happening again.
That really sucks, because I got to a point where there was some click issues, right? And I had to like figure out a system to select the thing that I needed to. So I had to like set the perfect filters to then select this person and then set another set of filters so I could select like that kind of stuff, which is, you know, that in a new game that happens, right? Like there's so many options and the games are still buggy. We're figuring them out.
Totally.
But I was lucky enough to get past it, and I haven't had any, you know, other issues.
Good. But
all that to say, the objective and daily quest systems are what teaches me to play the game, right? It shows me what's important.
It shows literally me the things shows that you what's important to do.
Right.
And that statement is it.
Yeah, that's
quests
it.
Quests need to tell the player what's important to do.
Right. And the rewards from doing it. The best feeling in a game like that is when you do a thing and it checks multiple boxes off, right? So now, like, sure. I've done something and I'm getting a quest reward, I'm getting a daily reward, I'm getting an upgrade on a character, like, all at once, and I'm like, all right, the importance is clear. Like, these are the kind of things I should focus on to make myself better at this game. But on top of that, there's still so many layers that you can experience and learn and, like, how to put the right team together, and for this particular type of content, this team is the best kind of thing to do in this current meta. Those things are not explicitly taught in the game, and I think that's good. I think that's the discoverable side of things, which keeps you interested in looking online and figuring out how that stuff happens. And I'm somebody that does too much of that, right? Like I'm spending my time min-maxing. Like the second I've hit my max in energy, it kills me to know that I'm not doing something with that energy, so I can't continue to gain. But like, that's where my brain is, like, all the time. Way too much. But I enjoy it. It's fun.
Well said. All that.
All right. What other questions we got here? Here's a good one. I think we're going to have a similar answer here. Should I get a degree for game programming or be self-taught? I also want to write and design games.
Oh,
that's a big, big question.
Well, you get one job, not three, but I get it. As a game designer who often wears many hats, I get it. So, I mean, fortunately, if you're good at programming, that will serve you in almost any discipline in game development. So that's always a safe direction. Do I think programmers are still going to be relevant down the road? Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's going to be a skill set that will only pay off, especially in America. Like, you probably already know that salaries are high for software engineers in America, but America is not so great at math, relatively speaking, to other countries with software engineers. So ours get paid really well. So if you have an affinity for it and you want financial security and other benefits that may come from it, yeah, that's a good first start. You care about game design, that's broad. You'll figure out more specifics as you go. And you said writing, so obviously there's going to be some love for narrative lore, how that ties possibly into quest systems and other systems design. And you'd be able to architect and implement all that yourself with programming knowledge.
Yeah.
So.
And they expanded their question a little bit, and I want to dig into this a little bit. They say, will programming still be in demand? It seems like everyone is learning to code. It's still a rare skill with, like, basically AI. AI is a thing, right? And here's the thing you need to understand about AI. You need to think about using AI to augment and supplement your skills. That's not right. Thinking about AI as something to replace what you're doing. Because absolutely, I can go talk to AI right now and be like, hey, make me this simple mobile app that does these things. Right? Like, it can do that kind of stuff for you, right? But that's not where the skill is, right? The skill is problem solving, right? And the AI is not going to problem solve for you. It'll do what you tell it to do. And when we're working on games with hundreds of people and there's this big code base, we're not putting AI in there to look through this code base and find out solutions to things, right? You have to have your experience and eye to look at this and dig in and figure out what the right solution is and then create that solution. And even at that point, it's iterative, right? Like, you're going to try things. They're not going to work. You're going to keep one system is augmented by another and you're touching other things. And like, it's not as simple as saying, hey, I need to make this new feature for my game. Can this AI make it for me?
Right. Right. And like, I don't know, ChatGPT, I use it like a search engine, right? That's what it is to me. It is a glory. I mean, not to oversimplify the awesomeness that it is. I don't mean to disrespect it. It's great, but I treat it like a glorified search engine, and it more than meets my needs. It helps me compile so much information so quickly and research so many things. You know, it's a couple years behind, so that doesn't help me with modern game design searching. Game design is not really a strong suit by any means right now for it, of course, because there's not much game design knowledge on the internet. What it's pulling from? So, LOL. But as we ask better questions into it, it shall get better.
Man, I'm gonna get a little insight into my recent talks with AI. So I have access to Google Bard, which I have through my Pixel, and I've been using it as an advisor recently. And obviously I'm not going to give it any confidential information or anything like that. But the thing I have been using it for is for this stream. And I've been talking to it about things like, hey, like basically trying to help it help me, you know, help broaden the audience or make sure people understand what we're trying to do. You know, those kind of things. And it's been really interesting. Basically, I have to tell it so much about me so that it knows how to answer my questions. And we're kind of building a rapport. And like, for instance, the social posts that I do now, I write one and then I tell it, hey, help me improve this post. And it'll help me reword. It'll be like, hey, if you want better engagement, you should try leading with this kind of comment or this kind of text and then lead in and then move into the other stuff you're talking about. That stuff is great. Like, I think that's what the AI is built for. The thing that surprised me was when I asked it, I said, hey, what do you know about Game Dev with a Shot of Jameson, which is the podcast and video version of this? The response shook me a little bit. It first of all said, I've watched a couple of episodes, which was wild, and then proceeded to describe the episodes. And I'm like, yep, you watched a couple of episodes. And then it told me, it gave me a brief synopsis of like, here's the kind of things it covers. Here's the value in it. Like all this stuff. And I'm just like looking at it like this thing actually researched it. And it wasn't like, hey, go look at this and then come back to me. It already had, which was wild.
Thank you for sharing that. I don't have words for that.
It's wild times, man.
Yeah.
When it was like, yeah, I watched a couple of episodes. I'm like, what? Like, oh, man. So we got a question in the chat here. Are there any newer innovative features from survival games that you would like to gush about? What are the most all survival games not doing right now that you would like to see?
Man, I get paid to answer that kind of stuff, man.
Not today.
No, I love it. I love it. I'll talk about this for free. Absolutely. So, all right. Don't let me talk too long on this, Jameson, for realsies, because this is like literally my career. Valheim and V Rising in no particular order, right? They both sold millions of copies in their first like month or two of existing, and they continue to do so through their early access careers of What, V Rising just hit their 2 year? Valheim just hit their 2 year. V Rising might have just passed their 1 year. I'm completely forgetting when V Rising came out now.
Roughly, right?
2 years. Yeah, so the new V Rising update came out today. It's their first major update. It's basically an expansion. You know, of a huge new zone that's really two zones in one. They redid a ton of stuff through the player journey from the first content to the last in terms of gear, in terms of potions, in terms of enemies. All the combat stuff's more diversified. There's a new spell school. There's new dual pistols. There's a new greatsword. Like, oh my god, the content that they've scaled. So yeah, V Rising is hot. It's hot.
I gotta check that out. Like, it's one that I keep looking at. People keep talking about, but I keep forgetting about. So I need to actually take a good look at that.
It is the best survival game ever designed, is my professional opinion on the subject. Like pros and cons. None of the survival games are perfect, but V Rising lacks an end game, and there's plenty of criticism there, and plenty of like, oh, well, you played the game, there's nothing to do. Well, yeah, that's every survival game. It's just the other survival games make you play for 400 hours first, and V Rising's respecting your time. That's weird. So I just really appreciate the game design behind V Rising because of that. It's like, I still have the full player journey, right? I start as a little fledgling vampire. One, I'm having a vampire fantasy, which sounds weird saying, but you know what I mean.
I'm with you.
From a combat perspective and a gameplay perspective, and not in a lot of non-combat ways, right? You're building a huge castle. You have all this amazing architecture that makes sense. Like, there's the full vampire fantasies there, and then you can choose to PvP or PvE to your heart's content through, like, 80-some bosses or something. It's a lot of content. Maybe it's not that many bosses. It's a lot of bosses, though.
How does V Rising handle new players? Like, is it a co-op game, or is it like what's the general setup for it?
Default clan size 4.
Okay.
Generally, it's expected that there's no more than 40 people on a server. The map is designed around the number 40 specifically, and they make that very clear. Even though there are servers like 100 plus people, which I can't even imagine the chaos, but because there's a finite amount of plots of land you can build on, and I mean that literally. Like, there are plots of land. You take one over and then you build on it.
Okay.
And no one else can build on that plot. Even if you're way over on this end and the plot's super long, like, no one's building down there. It's your plot of land now. And so anyway, it's just built on the smaller scale, free-for-all PvP kind of situation. You're all vampires fighting over Dracula's throne. And there's some other really cool in-game stuff to chase around that subject. Ultimately, the fantasy, like the vision for V Rising is that you will either become Dracula or otherwise replace him. And there's a whole area in the middle of the map that we can't get to that I think is going to be for that.
Okay.
But I didn't answer half the question. I'm just gushing about V Rising.
No, that's good too.
You know, the other half being like, oh, what's something, what was it that's been going wrong that people aren't doing well in survival games? Somewhere in that sentiment. So, like, well, I think end game is really the answer. That's the answer. No one is building an end game for players. And, like, every game has to come to an end, or, you know, kind of sort of should. And I get all that. But systems design very specifically specializes in procedural or otherwise regenerated content with possibly improved rewards with increased difficulties, right? You've seen this 100 times or more. So I just think the genre hasn't really embraced that side yet. I don't quite understand why, and I hope some survival games start doing that soon.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Now, there's other ways to have an end game for people. Like I'm kind of saying that thinking about a couple types of players in mind. This doesn't apply to everyone. For example, there's the role players. Fantastic communities in these games. And the role players will chill on a V Rising server or a Conan Exiles server for months, if not years, and don't really need new content because they're providing that for each other through the community. Right. That's incredible. Players like me don't get that. Professionally, I understand that, but like as a player, that's not something I seek. So I am looking for what's that next content that I can overcome, what's that next challenge that I can tangibly beat and possibly even beat in front of other people so I can swag about it or get something cool from beating it that I can swag with, you know, that whole loop.
That
not toxic, just swag.
No, I'm with you. And that's something that's a place you and I are a little different, but not in a bad way, right? Like I totally understand that vibe of like, I want people to know that I'm king shit of this, right? Like there's an absolute motivation for that. It's not one that I have, right? Like it's not a motivating factor for me, but this is why we have how many different types of player types out here that we're always considering when we're designing something.
Sure.
So, let's see, there was something here. Oh, right. Have you played any tabletop survival based games? Kingdom's Death survival, attrition throughout its campaign, or Dead Winter zombie survival with the secret traitor mechanics?
Okay. That's a question. So the term
Asked
survival...
by a board game designer, so...
Well, I own two of those games, so first of all, I understand, but like... The survival's being used very broad, or survival's being used very broadly here.
True.
So the question's more like the tone. Is the tone survival?
Yeah.
Are there a ton of well, I guess in those games there are a bunch of resources to manage, kind of depending. Dead of Winter I adore, side note. That is such a good game design, and all the expansions are amazing, and I wish I had like 10 real friends that live near me to do the super duper have your own settlements and fight each other in PvP expansion. Crazy that these analog games can pull off this kind of game design. Let's these are the kind it. Of things you will never see in a video game.
Let's do it this fall, man. Let's do it.
Yo! Oh, we gotta fit that. I'm going to CCP's 20th year, right? For Eve Fan Fest, because I've never celebrated Eve, and I've never been to Iceland, so 1-2. And my name's on a couple statues now, so like, you gotta go see that. And, not in like a cool way, and like, I was in the right place at the right time in a video game way. And then BlizzCon. Dude, that's within like 5 or 6 weeks.
You got a lot going on this fall. I do too, but we got to find the time. We'll make it happen.
Yeah, I'm not done anything in a few months, so I guess I'm charging up.
But dude, it's interesting that just to quickly talk about the amount of cool shit that board games are doing in these kind of realms. Like they're emulating a lot of stuff that are typically game or video game type systems and mechanics, and it's awesome. Like I love the thing that I love more about, like, I will sit around a table with people more than I will playing something online with a group. Like I'm just more apt to do that, and like getting those same kind of mechanics around a table is really nice. Like it's really cool. I need to see you. I need to interact with you. But
things take so much longer, man.
I know.
Yeah. Like, well, but 2/3 of this is automation. If there were just more sophisticated systems designed that automated otherwise arbitrary steps in all these games, so system design could solve that. That is a solvable area.
I'm with you. And also,
that's what drives me away.
The thing that I have not done yet is played a digital board game with everyone having cameras on. Like, I think that might help kind of get that vibe too.
I would love us to play the Game of Thrones one.
That's the one I keep thinking of.
On Steam.
Let's do it. Like it's
for really real.
That's the one I keep thinking about, because like the having a game take care of the basic mechanics and moving, like the speed, like you're talking about, the speed with which we can accomplish the tasks when things are automated, or at least like, oh, I can't do that. The game won't let me do that. The rules don't let me do that. We don't have to debate it. Right, like that's awesome, because our group debates a lot, right?
Like, yeah,
we debate a lot, and that's because a lot of us have those instincts, those intuitions, right? Where we want to min max and we want to make sure we understand the rules. We're all game developers, so like I get it. But when the game tells us constantly what those rules are, I think that helps us a lot. So we need to figure that out.
Yeah, avoiding all that conflict and misunderstanding of rules is the number one reason I prefer analog game design in a like two-dimensional digital format.
Yeah,
I'm with Fantasy Flight and others would just keep cranking those out.
All right, we got to figure that out. We got to do that more, and we can do digital no matter what, so we don't have to congregate. So.
And there are leaderboards.
Oh, of course you would bring up leaderboards. I love it. All right, let's see. You might not be able to talk about it, but how overarching can the quests be? In Valheim, you have a quest to kill the region bosses, and players can interact with the rest of the game to progress with the quest. What will quests be like that? I guess we're talking about Fractured Veil now.
Sure. So I don't know what the final quests are going to look like for Fractured Veil. I've got a lot designed in a spreadsheet, and we'll see how many get built and in what ways exactly and location and all that. But we've got a lot of good stuff designed and ready to be put in the engine. Oh my gosh, what's the actual question though? That's not an answer.
Talking about the you have quests to kill the region bosses and the players can interact with that.
Oh yeah, what can we do? I've requested for a lot of conditions to exist in the quest editor, right? So you know, from a game design perspective, I want to be able to check things like, hey, does the player have this item in their inventory? If so, I need that to trigger a successful step in a quest line. Hey, I need to check if the player killed that specific AI enemy type. I need to check, did the player walk into that particular volume under these conditions? I need to check, was the player, and I can be more complex than one condition, right? I can be like, was the player in the right place, but at midnight when the moon was above them? Or like, whatever. You can always combine conditions in these kinds of systems. But the point is, yeah, all the things that you could expect from MMO quest design, we definitely have those conditions. So all the fetch quest stuff, and that's not a nice term, but it's what it is, you know, go collect the 10 things, go take this from A to B. So delivery, there's the same few modular quest like structures that exist in all video games. Yeah, we got that.
It's exciting times, man.
The tool, I can't praise the tools enough. The studio behind me is like ridiculous at making their own tools.
That's great.
I hope one day I'm like doing my own thing and I can afford to pay for their tools genuinely. Like one day I hope to do that.
Nice. And that, yeah. The nice thing on top of that is you've got the base of Unreal, right? Which is already incredible.
Yeah, it's just a bunch of really tools. Good plugins for Unreal 5. Yeah,
that's really nice.
Yeah,
is any of that stuff going to be available like on the store, or is it, or like, is I ask that as a general thing, is this the kind of thing that teams think about when they're building tools like this?
Yeah. I don't speak for the company, to be super clear, right? But yeah, I believe that the intention would be to sell that stuff if they're not already.
Yeah, because every place I've worked has had a proprietary engine. So this kind of discussion has never really come up.
But this is the cooler way to do it. Because it's your proprietary stuff on top of this amazing tool set that is easily to employ. This is a skill set that people have you can hire for.
100% agree. I will say, though, most of my career has been in open world games, right? And most engines have not done historically have not been built to do open world stuff, right? Like, and so up through most of my, like when we were at Volition, we tried out Unreal, we tried Crytek, we tried something else. Like we tried stuff before building the latest engine that was there, but we just found that it was going to take so much proprietary stuff to get it to work the way we needed it to, the engine wasn't quite ready for it. I don't know that that's true anymore. I feel like
it's not.
Modern engines are handling it better. Yeah, exactly. And so, like, I feel like even bigger studios have the opportunity now to think about it that way.
Oh yeah.
Hmm.
It's just so cool. It's so cool to be able to take a very powerful AAA game engine and then just start plugging in new functionality.
Hmm.
Just conceptually, just the modularity of that. Like, of course, that's where we should be.
And the best part from your perspective is just to be like, I wish the engine would do this. And then if we have people on the team that agree, now it does this, right? Like that's
right. And we're smart enough to make it a modular plugin usually.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Oh man. I love it. Yeah. Thoughts on 7 Days to Die as it comes to Survivor games. What are they doing right versus wrong? I don't know the game.
Sure. We need to play that one day too, sir. Okay. 7 Days to Die is a pretty legendary survival game. Probably like top 10 most famous ever, but like most popular ever. It's very much Siege mechanics, right? So that game is less about... So it's got the... Let me get my words straight. Let's call it a survival simulation.
Okay.
Simulation survival. Very specifically, I want to use that term, right? You think simulator. Think Arma. Think that DayZ, that direction, right?
Okay. I'm interested.
That's the experience you're kind of having going in. That's the player controller. That's the clunkiness, for lack of a better term, right? That's just the way the game feels and the expectations you may have. Okay. So you go in like that. Now, the game is also claimed to be in pre-alpha for like 47 years. I don't even know how long. Okay. An extremely long time, like longer than my career, possibly.
Still in
some weird pre-alpha state. But like, okay, whatever works. Like, words. They've sold however many copies and been a very successful game. But yeah, sorry. So it's about siege mechanics. So it's a zombie game, survival sim, get guns, boom, boom, find canned food, bottled water, all the things. There is terraforming, as I recall. Haven't played it in a while. I didn't mess with that much. I normally try to find a house and then start like trying to live out of it and mess with the surroundings. But effectively, if you played like a Call of Duty zombies mode where you're just defending an area from waves of zombies, that's the effective climax of the 7 days. Every 7 days, you are going to be like super sieged.
Oh, okay.
And, you're basically preparing.
So you got
for that
7 days to prepare for the next onslaught.
That's right. That's okay. Right. That's the concept. And then there's just all these cool ass tools you can use as a player to prepare for it.
Okay.
And the collaboration's huge, right? So it's like, hey, you know, if there's enough of us, we might be able to actually build a legitimate moat and just, you know, all kinds of cool things that, depending on the scale of your manpower, literally, the game allows you to have access to almost new content entirely, depending on how you want to shake it out.
Okay.
So yeah, I mean, it's positive, but yeah, the kind of like, I don't know if it's a negative, but it's like, when are they going to launch? And what does that mean? And there's probably a roadmap. I should just go Google. But that game has been pre-alpha forever.
All right.
A lot of fun. Definitely worth the playing. I went to my dentist a couple years ago. Best dentist of my life I have here now. And one of the ladies that was checking me out, because she knew I was a game developer, she was like, have you ever heard of 7 Days to Die? And I was like, yeah, absolutely. I work in that genre. And yeah, so I guess that was like 6 months ago, actually. Mm. But anyway, that's like her favorite game. And I was like, wow. Man, of all the games you could be into,
that's crazy.
This is the one. And you randomly told me today on this Tuesday afternoon. But
I had the same dentist experience, but I just had to choose a new one because they're not in my network anymore.
Oh,
so it was like, dude's a total gamer. Like every time I come in, it's all we would talk about. But I'm like, I'm not going to pay $100 for a cleaning that's free anywhere else. Like that's not worth the conversation to me,
man.
Oh, that's a bummer though, because I really did enjoy going there. He actually doesn't take any insurance. It's just like, it's like this weird, weird setup he has. But anyway, all right. I see some questions. I'm trying to understand. Hold on, let me look at this. If you ever make over $1 million. I'm not quite following the question, but it gives me a question. If you have money, like a lot of money, and you could do whatever you wanted to game development wise, what would you do? Would you start your own studio? Would you what would you want to do? Yeah.
Yeah, I've got a vision I would absolutely execute with my own studio.
Okay. Is that, I don't want your ideas, but is that, are you thinking like build studio game idea, bring in people that you want to work with? Like, is that the kind of thing you're thinking about?
Yeah, definitely start with people I want to work with at all costs, like even at compromising the idea some, like getting the right people early would be everything to me.
Okay. I still have this dream. I have a dream.
Oh, take my dream, dude.
Of a literal, and we've talked about this, but like a literal, let's build a neighborhood, like a physical neighborhood where we all live. We all build houses.
How do you land up here, man?
That's what I'm saying. And then we have like a central space.
Yeah, it was a shared office space.
Yeah, that we all work
right by the pool.
I want to do this. Like, I still want to do this.
Yeah, like somewhere between Raleigh and Durham, North Carolina. That's a great area somewhere in the Research Triangle Park.
That's what I hear.
Like 10 acres figured out.
It's so funny because while I love that idea, I also want to retire from Insomniac. Like, I love what I'm doing so much and like the situation that I'm in.
Yeah.
The thing that I don't like about the proposed company is I don't want the responsibility of running a company, thinking about people's things like healthcare and making sure we have enough money to do. Like, if there's unlimited money, I would do
my best to hire people to offset those responsibilities 100%. And try to still be like this weird. Yeah, I would need a cabinet effectively, right? I would need help for all of that.
Yeah, I don't want to deal with any of that.
To be creative.
But it means we need a lot more money, right? Like, we need a lot of money to make something like that happen.
I could make my vision with 20 people.
Oh, yeah. 20.
Like 20 people, 3 years.
20 is that's a lot of people. How many of them are tech artists?
I got a vision.
Like, it better be most.
Yeah, like four.
Yeah, there's better be a good number of tech artists and tech designers in that group before we're going to do something for real.
Yeah, they're my best friends.
Dude,
I don't know if
I know who those 20 people are in my head. Like I could immediately, I'm not going to, but I could immediately be like, we need this person.
Yeah.
Like at least 10 of them where I'm like, we need a foundation of these 10 people. If we have that, anything is possible. Literally anything.
So I really like Oxygen, but you could put the studio in Asheville, North Carolina with the neighborhood, just saying.
I hear a lot of great things about Asheville.
Yeah. I've always talked to Mark Diaz about that. I'm like, man, one day you and me, we are making a studio in Asheville.
That's where he's from, right?
That is where he's from.
Yeah.
And I'm from like 2 hours down the road. So.
Yeah. See, that's the thing. I really want to be in the Pacific Northwest. I really do. Like that's the place that's been calling me literally my entire life. But at the same time, it's like, well, there's a lot of game developers there, right? Like there's no shortage for sure. But when we talk about this kind of thing, I'm like, where could we go that's super cheap that we could buy a bunch of land, build our own compound, and just like just do all the cool shit we've always talked about. Like, that's the real dream, right?
It is.
All right, I got a fifth shot I got to take here. Man, and we've only got so like
you put four. That means you had just taken the fourth.
The fourth was earlier. This is number five.
Okay.
And I have a special song I normally play for this, but it'll get like copyright, so I can't play it anymore. But we're gonna do number five anyway.
Okay. Excellent.
All right, we got a little bit of time left. What haven't we covered? What's on your mind? What's exciting you? Like, what are you looking forward to game wise? Have you played the new Zelda?
No.
Let me tell you why I have not played the new Zelda. Because I got frustrated with weapons that break in the last one.
I really have such friction with the first one that I just didn't finish it and have no interest. But I understand it's going to be like game of the year worthy. Of course it is. And like my wife's playing it. I see it across the way. Like I can't handle that friction. I can't handle like my weapons breaking. I don't understand the value. There are so many other ways you could drive the behavior you mean to drive without making me feel bad about it. But that could be a cultural thing too. And obviously it's specific to like us because most people seem to be okay with it.
I don't, man. Here's me speaking purely as someone with crippling anxiety, right? I cannot stand the thought that I can't use my best stuff because it's going to break soon and then I won't have it to use when something harder shows up. So I spend an entire game like this using middle of the road weapons and never touching my big shit because I'm afraid of the moment that's going to come when I need it and I won't have it.
Would it be better if you had duplicates of each of them? Like, does that mitigate your concern or
it
not?
It would, but then that's a lot of work, right? And a lot of inventory space. And that's the way I play. Like my inventory is filled with weapons because I know I'm going to need them.
Right.
Wait, so Kyle in the chat is saying he loves the weapon degradation. Why? Why do you love it? Like, to me, it is the worst. I understand the reasoning or the thought behind it, but when I'm mostly walking around swinging a stick at people, that doesn't feel like I'm in a game. It doesn't feel like a heroic fantasy for me. And I don't know how to like reconcile with that.
Yep. I don't know. I mean, that's part of it. And well, yeah, no, I'm aligned. I acknowledge that it's super good. I just don't understand this part about it.
Yeah.
Like all the other elements of game design in Breath of the Wild, I get it.
Yep.
I have solved a lot of puzzles in my life. I've played a lot of games, solved a lot of puzzles. So when you hand a game in front of me that's like, hey, here's like another 120 shrines or something, you want to go solve these puzzles? I'm like, no, I've literally solved all these puzzles, I assure you, in some other context.
Yeah.
So puzzles just really drive me away these days in an RPG. Or I just hope I can avoid a lot of them.
Yeah. My son and I had that same conversation yesterday. So he's got the same frustrations I do about not, you know, weapons degrading and not... But the other is the puzzles, where I'm like, I appreciate a puzzle. I understand a puzzle. I get it. But I don't like puzzles. Like, I don't want to spend my time figuring out this thing should go here to make this thing happen. That's just not something that I personally care about. And the more we talk about this, I'm realizing I don't think the new Zelda games are for me. Like,
that's all it is, right? Just not the demographic. That's right.
But I love, like, the original Zelda is literally the reason I do what I do. Like, it's,
and you can play that on your Switch right now, buddy.
I know. And or on my Classic Edition, right? But seriously, I feel like after I played like 20 hours of Breath of the Wild and gave it up, that, like, Elden Ring did a better job of what that game tried to do for me than Breath of the Wild did. And they did similar things, right? Like, the thing that both of them did very well is the way they laid out the world, right? Like, you can go anywhere you want to go at any time, but you're going to get your ass kicked unless you've done some things to prepare yourself for the area that you're about to go into, right? And... there, I want to replay some Elden Ring and not play a stealthy rogue because that was a terrible choice and it was very difficult. But
I feel like somebody tried to tell you that.
Yeah, I know. But that's my instinct, right? Like the way that I shoot, when I have that choice, I'm a stabby, stealthy guy, right? Like that's just the way that I do.
We can do dual Reduvius for you. Like, we can get you these cool blood daggers pretty quick. It is viable, but only with those.
Then that may be the conversation we should have.
Yeah.
Because I eventually, with Elden Ring, got to the point where I was like, I feel like I've experienced it. I understand the game. I'm not going to finish it. I'm going to move on. I should go back and finish it because that game is fantastic. Their level design is my favorite, right? Because it's so good because you can always see the thing you're trying to get to. And it's always like, oh, that's on another plateau. How do I get to that plateau? Up and down, right? Like, it's just
all
like,
around first.
It's just so all
these,
good.
There's these geographic choices, right?
It's coupled by
sometimes there's really cool stuff that you can't see as the player yet on the other side of that mountain or cliff or structure.
Right.
And it, yeah, very, very well done.
Oh, man. See, I need to dig. Wait, do they have a DLC? Is it out yet or did they just announce it?
It is only announced, Shadow of the Erdtree.
That's what'll bring me back, I think. And
I think we were told it will not come out before Armored Core. And Armored Core comes out August 25th, I think. Something like that.
Are you a mech guy? Like, are you?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes.
Is
I kind of grew away from Mech Warrior and the more heavy simulation-y side.
Yeah.
But like, I don't know. Gundam Evolution most recently is like a pretty decent Hawken-esque experience. So Gundam IP is cool, but Armored Core is like the perfect middle ground. It's like the right place for mech player controllers for me.
All right.
My first Armored Core was actually Armored Core Arena, not even one of the numbered ones. And I remember building like all the Gundams from the Gundam Wing anime at the time in it and stuff. And I was like losing my mind over these cool little fantasies I was getting to play. And then I just kind of played every other Armored Core along the way.
Without ever
realizing from software did Armored Core until, I don't know.
Oh, I didn't
about
know that.
10 years ago, I connected those dots and I was like, oh my gosh.
I didn't realize it until recently.
Armored Core people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Like, I'm not a big mech guy in general, but Mech Warrior was one of my first, like, tabletop RPGs where, you know, where I first learned about things like attacking a torso, like, you know, like targeting specific areas of something because you can think about the increased damage, you know, like those kind of thoughts. That was like my earliest like foray into strategic RPG thinking, I guess you'd say. But I've never been like I'm not a Gundam guy. I don't like Voltron didn't really resonate with me. Like the mech side of things have not been a big thing for me. But when I saw the Armored Core stuff that's out, they showed recently, it was interesting. Like there was a little excitement there for me. And so cool. I'm curious if that's something that I should look into, if that's the right place to like really explore that area, if that makes sense.
I mean, certainly, but it's about going in with the right perspective too. So right. Like one perspective that you may share, I enjoy piloting vehicles in reality. I've always had an affinity for it. I really like doing it. It gives me a joy and a high nothing else in life does. I love piloting vehicles. So that applies when you're like, oh, the new Ace Combat came out. And I'm like, oh, Ace Combat. I'm always there for Ace Combat.
Okay.
Or, you know, like, oh, the next Armored Core in this case comes out. I'm like, yep. Every time that IP makes a game, I will be there because that is me getting to pilot that fantasy. And there's just no other product that can give me that. But yeah, different vehicles for different IPs, of course.
All right.
Not really into racing anymore.
I've never really looked into Ace Combat. I need to look into that.
Oh, Ace Combat. Oh. Yeah, I really enjoy the Ace Combat combat system.
When I think of this kind of stuff, I think way back, like Super Nintendo, UN Squadron, like that. That's I don't do those kind of games anymore, but I loved them back in the day. There was a point where flight games moving to 3D was a big turnoff for me. There was like the controls and like how it kind of happened and like in that, you know, late Nintendo, Super Nintendo, early Nintendo 64 days where like with Star Fox and those kind of things. Like it didn't pull me in the same way. I'm not sure how much of that was just like the clunkiness of like the you know, the games learning what they are and kind of figuring that stuff out. But I'll look at Ace Combat because that's, I do love flight stuff. All right.
Well, and the, another softball from out of nowhere, BattleTech.
Mm-hmm.
I just got a DM about BattleTech too. And I was like, that's a good call. I'm just gonna call that out real quick. If you don't know the BattleTech IP, that, especially with your love of tactics, I really should have said that sooner. That, yeah, BattleTech.
Okay.
I can help link stuff later too, but yeah. That's like some brutal tactics. Like permanent bad things in your campaign tactics.
Oh. I just got redeemed. I have to say that I'm the goat of design. Which is absolutely not true. But you guys out there killing me. Wait, have you played Star Citizen yet?
Me?
Yeah.
No.
All right.
I've watched quite a few streams off and on through the years, but mostly DJ.
Yeah,
when DJ
plays,
I'll catch
that's
a bunch.
I see it too. His is RPG folk or like roleplay focus too, which is this is a place that frankly I'm not at. Like I'm not a role player when it comes to like just, you know, that style of things. I personally am more of a, I don't know. I love playing role-playing games. I never quite think of myself as in the role of the person that I'm playing as. I think more of like I'm controlling someone. I'm controlling something. I make choices.
Not immersive at all.
No. Let me. I'm trying to think of the right way to say this. I'm not someone who wants to outwardly demonstrate that I'm actively acting as this person. But when I'm playing the game, my choices are based on that person.
Third person role play.
Yes.
If you were playing D&D tabletop right now, you would be narrating what your character's doing instead of role playing it.
Generally, yes. That's the way that I tend to approach things. So when I look at something like, am I immersed in this? It's different for me, right? Like my choices are definitely based on what I think that character should do, but mm-hmm. I do not think I'm the character.
Got it.
And I think a lot of people put themselves in that role, and that's totally cool, and I like that.
That's what I do.
That's not me. That's not the way that I tend to approach it.
Word. Yeah, it's all about escapism, man.
I agree.
You know, I need a lot of escapism, so I got really good at that.
That's interesting, because I feel like mine is also escapism in for me. Like where I'm.
Yeah, sorry, I don't mean to invalidate the right. It could be.
You're right. No. I didn't mean that as much as like. I think the ideas are the same. My approach is different, but I'm getting the same kind of vibe out of it, or the same kind of accomplishment out of it. Maybe.
Sure.
Like I'm constantly like when I play a game like Mass Effect, right? I'm constantly making choices based on what I would do in that scenario, but I don't think of me as Shepard. I think of me controlling Shepard.
In that case, I agree. I definitely couldn't be Shepard.
But it's my Shepard.
Dragon Age, I was me.
But it's my Shepard at the same time, which is weird, right? Like I don't know. It's a weird kind of spot in between the two. I don't know. But you know what's funny? We just ran out of time.
As we do. As one does.
I love conversations like this because we went all over the place. Plus, the time flew by, right? Like it's been 2 hours, and that took way too little time, it feels like. And somebody asked earlier what my shirt's about. This is the shirt for our dev team on Wolverine. Like I've done some contributions to that game already, even though I'm working on Spider-Man. So I just wanted to address that real quick. But we That's all this is. It's our dev team shirt for this. It's good. We all get one. It's a t-shirt that I enjoy wearing. All right, man. I'm going to jump off here, say my goodbyes. Is there anything before we go that you wanted to make sure that you touched on tonight? Anything on your mind that you're like, oh, man, I wish that we had got to talk about X or Y? I mean, it's okay if we cover it.
You know, no, as always, you know, please find me on any relevant social media. And if you look me up on LinkedIn, the rest of my stuff should be in my contact info to make it easy. You're welcome to ping me about, you know, learning material, other conversations of games, whatever. Happy to try to chat.
All right.
Also on Jameson's Discord, obviously. You can ping me there. That might be the easiest thing.
That's a real good place to be. I'm gonna throw that in the chat right now. Everybody,
because then whatever we're talking about, whoever else is reading could benefit from it too. So we can just have conversations going there.
And quickly, I'm also open to improvements as far as the Discord itself, and you know the stream goes. Like if there's things that people feel like we're not touching on enough, or areas that we wish we could have better chats about, let me know. We'll figure that stuff out. But for now, thank you. I really appreciate you joining me. This has been, as usual, a great conversation. I'm going to go back and see how many times you've been on, because I feel like I'm underselling it. There was a point, though, you're right, where I was like, hey, I'm going to have Will on again. Like, we have great conversations. Like
every 6 weeks or something, I was still coming back,
So, yeah, we're going to go check that out. But seriously, though, I appreciate it. And we'll find some time for you to come back on in the near future and talk about, you know, how Fractured Veil's launch went, and then you know, whatever else is going on in your life, and it'll be good times. But I appreciate you, and I will talk to you soon.
Cool, thank you.
Appreciate you, buddy. Later. Hey, thanks for watching. Don't forget to subscribe and turn on notifications below so you'll know when new episodes are ready. If you're interested in the audio version of the podcast, I've got links for that in the show notes for you. And if you want to join us live and get your own questions answered, we're at twitch.tv/JamesonDural every Wednesday night at 7 p.m. Eastern. Have a good week, and we'll see you soon. Is this a case where you were handed a finished model first, like, because, you know, it's a simulation, right? So it should be like built to spec, where normally we would build something out, we'd rough something out, you know, and get the play part of it done before it becomes beautiful. Was it the opposite way for this?
So when I got there, they already kind of had like a mock of like a rough kind of outline model of the ship that they built, then all the spaces inside, like each compartment was kind of like roughed out. But then we had to go through the process of going into each space and then replacing all the rough blockout stuff with the realistic models and all the interactables and all that kind of stuff. So the levels